Strange things happen in life that seem to be odd circumstances. But for those of us of faith, when we take a closer look, we can see the hand of God. John Newton, 18th century preacher, previously who was a slave trader, experienced this marvelous providence in his life that he liked to call the grace of God. In a ship where he was employed as a mate, he arrived late. The ship sailed, and the first day at sea, it sank, and almost all aboard were lost. Several years later, in Africa, he was in charge. He was the first mate of the ship, and he was in charge of a longboat that would go to shore and bring provisions back for the journey back to England. It was a process that took several days, and one day, the captain came up, and he said, Newton, he arbitrarily took him off of that assignment, put another person in his place, and gave no explanation for it. And that night, that boat sank, and all those men were drowned. Later, the captain said, I don't know really why I took you off, other than that this thought was so imperative that I take you off of that assignment. Newton writes about those experiences as God's mercy preserving his life. Similarly, David in the Psalms writes about experiences where God saved his life and incredible experiences. We are looking in 1 Samuel, and Saul, with an army of 3,000 men, had pinned David down on a mountainside. So David could not escape except to go forward where Saul's army of 3,000 men was. And Saul was zeroing in on him, and was just about to capture him, which his plan was to kill David and all of his followers, when suddenly word reaches Saul that the Philistines have attacked and Saul must withdraw and immediately answer this attack. And David's life is spared. But David never considered that a coincidence. He considered it, the timing was all too obvious. It was God's grace in preserving his life. Today we're looking at an event, you would almost think that it is the same event repeated. In fact, liberal scholars have said, well, this must be the same event, and the writers of the Bible have gotten mixed up. No, it's not the same event. It is God's grace which is repeated over and over. David has the opportunity to spare Saul's life a second time in chapter 26 that we are going to look at today. We're going to begin with verse number 1, and I will not read the whole section. I'll read it as I get to it. Verse number 1 of 1 Samuel chapter 26. The Ziphites went to Saul at Gibeah and said, Is not David hiding on the hill of Hakilah, which faces Jeshimon? Now, these people who live in Ziph, they are betting on the fact that Saul eventually is going to win this battle with David, because all of Israelite knows that David will maybe become king. But these people have decided, you know what, David's never going to become king. Saul's going to remain king. He's going to kill David. We're going to put all of our eggs in one basket, and they're going to supply information, hoping that Saul will look favorably to them. Here's what they did back in chapter 23. The Ziphites went up to Saul at Gibeah and said, Is not David hiding among us at the stronghold of Horesh on the hill of Hakilah south of Jeshimon? And that's the incident I previously described where Saul had David pinned down. Now they've done it a second time. Now Jeshimon, where David has been hiding for quite some time, in Hebrew means wasteland or wilderness. And certainly the wilderness of that area is one of the driest arid areas of the world. And this is where David lived as a fugitive, forced away from any normal life in the society of the Israelite nation. And this is all thanks to Saul, who pursues him as a fugitive. Now, these Ziphites certainly are opportunists, and they come to Saul with second time with news. But we wonder what will be Saul's reaction when he receives the word from the Ziphites, because back in chapter 23, Saul had clearly acknowledged that he was wrong for pursuing David when David gave a speech to him and ask him why he was pursuing him. I'm no more than a flea to you, a flea on a dead dog. And Saul had acknowledged that he was wrong. He had no reason to pursue David, that David had never done him any harm, and even conceded that David would one day be king. So when word comes the second time, would Saul be different? Would he have changed? I mean, he promised to change. He told David he would. Well, we don't have to look very far, wait very far to find out that he had not changed in verse 2. So Saul went down to the desert of Ziph with his 3,000 select Israelite troops to search there for David. Despite what had happened in the En-Gedi cave, Saul's promises count for nothing. He is pursuing David. And he goes with 3,000 men. We've been told David had 600, so that means David and his men are outnumbered 5-1. Saul hasn't changed, and they arrive where the Ziphites have told them to. Saul made his camp beside the road on the hill of Hakilon facing Jeshimon. But this time the information seems to be inaccurate. Maybe it's old, and David is not where they say he is. He's not on the hill, as he's been reported. Obviously, Saul would have liked to have the advantage of surprise. But when he gets there, he doesn't find David. He doesn't have that. And David happens to be in a place where Saul cannot see him, but David can see Saul. So David quickly takes the initiative to his side. He saw, that's David, he saw that Saul had followed him there. He sent out scouts and learned that Saul had definitely arrived. Oh, from a distance, David probably presumed this was Saul and his army, and maybe he presumed that he's back to finding him, but understandably, he too wonders if maybe Saul has changed. So they return, that is Saul, he's got his men, they're on a hunt-to-kill mission for you, David. So if David had had any hope that Saul had changed, he realizes that it's gone. Yes, it's Saul, and he's hunting for you. In verse 5, then David set out and went to a place where Saul had camped. He saw where Saul and Abner, son of Ner, the commander of the army, had laid down. Saul was lying inside the camp with the army encamped around him. So from the vantage point where David is, he can see the camp. He can see Saul is surrounded by his armies in the middle. He has his spears tucked in the ground right by his head. And David can see that. So what will David do right now? Before, he had shown self-restraint back in the cave of En-Gedi. Saul had promised to change. Saul does not change, right? Hasn't changed. Would this change anything with David? So David proposes this daring feat that only David would propose. There are two men there. In verse 6, David then asked Ahimelech the Hittite and Abishai, son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, who will go down into the camp with me to Saul? I'll go with you, said Abishai. Abimelech is a foreigner. David seems to have accumulated several of these foreigners who are brave men who follow David along with their families because they've been ousted by Saul. It's created an enormous amount of enemies. But Abishai, who's a nephew of David, is quick to respond. So we know that Abishai and his two brothers become loyal followers of David. And we're told in 1 Chronicles that they are sons of his sister. Their sister were Zeruiah and Abigail. Zeruiah's three sons were Abishai, Joab, and Asahel. These three very loyal, brave followers, but very strong-headed. It is Abishai who says, I'll go, David. I'll go with you. So David and just one man go to this camp of 3,000. They're going in at night. It seems like an extraordinary feat because these men are well-armed, and if they wake up, David could be apprehended immediately. But they execute their mission in verse 7. So David and Abishai went to the army by night, and there was Saul lying asleep inside the camp with his spear stuck in the ground near his head. Abner and the soldiers were lying around him. For the king to be laying there and someone to be able to enter the camp, it seems like security is sorely inadequate. There's no sentries on watch. The whole army seems to be completely overconfident and inept at protecting their king. So they found Saul easily, and they've entered the camp. Abishai is quick to volunteer, let me just take care of him right now. Abishai said to David, today God has delivered your enemy into your hands. Well, this is what David's men had whispered to him when he was back in the cave and in Gedi. And David refused, showing restraint. Abishai says, let me pin him to the ground with one thrust of the spear, his own spear. I won't strike him twice. Now back when the men had encouraged David that he should kill Saul, and David showed restraint, Abishai is saying, I will do the deed. Now, maybe it makes more sense now because Saul hasn't changed. Maybe Abishai's request is more reasonable. The hostility that Saul has shown maybe should be answered with that kind of hostility. But David had chosen to not show vengeance to Saul and leave Saul in God's hands. Now he has to answer that question again the second time. David may have done that, except the experience of the previous chapter where David had experienced with Nabal and Abigail has reinforced the idea that David needed to leave his enemies in God's hands, that vengeance belonged to the Lord. So David knows the answer to what he will do. But David said to Abishai, don't destroy him. Who can lay a hand on the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? David's experience with Nabal, where he was planning on murdering the entire household, male household of Nabal, and God stopped him from doing that, confirmed that it was right to allow God to deal with his enemies. We know that from the very moment that God sent the prophet Samuel to David's house when he was just 17, and many years have passed, God chose David to be the anointed. Shortly after that, God rejected Saul. So David lives with this, knowing that he is anointed to be king, and he also knows that Saul has been rejected. Yet David has to restrain himself from taking the opportunity to make things happen for himself and to wait for God. David also knows that if Saul was in his place, Saul would eliminate David. There's no question. But the answer becomes plain for David in a speech that he's about to give, and we're going to read that speech in just a moment. But this is exactly what our Lord did when he began his ministry. His ministry began in a wilderness, the same wilderness where David is. And it was in that wilderness that the enemy, Satan, came to Jesus and tempted him. Why struggle for the kingdom? Why live through all of these hardships? And Jesus knew that the cross was before him, and Satan knew the cross was before him. Why not allow me to give you the glory and the kingdom? And Jesus said no, that he would wait for his Father. And here David says no to that temptation. No to Abishai's way. He would do it God's way. I'm sure Abishai was perplexed. I'm sure his men would be perplexed when they find out what has happened. Here is the speech that he gives to Abishai. I'm sure it was in a whisper because they're still in the camp of the enemy. As surely as the Lord lives, he said, the Lord himself will strike him, or his time will come and he will die, or he will go into battle and perish. But the Lord forbid that I should lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. Now get the spear and water jug that are near his head and let's go. Now, David exercises this restraint, this trust in the Lord that God will fulfill his promises. It's interesting here. He tells Abishai, get the spear, get the water jug, but he doesn't trust Abishai because in the next verse, David grabs them himself. Now get the spear, the water jug that are near his head and let's go. Now look at verse 12. So David took the spear and the water jug near Saul's head and they left. On second thought, let me have the spear. Let me have the, probably a little too tempting to Abishai. David takes these because they're symbolic. And we will learn so much. This is the action of the plot. And now we will hear the speeches. But there's an interesting commentary here that is so important because God is in control of everything. As I mentioned in the opening, how what may seem to be circumstances, God's hand is behind it. And the fact that David could go into this camp of 3,000 and none of them wake up, there was more than just David and Abishai are very quiet. God had put the army to sleep. No one saw or knew about it, nor did anyone wake up. They were all sleeping because, notice this, the Lord had put them into a deep sleep, all 3,000. On an April the 8th, I remember that date, not particularly the year, but it's our daughter's birthday, our home was broken into in Corrientes, Argentina, sometime during the night, and the thieves entered many rooms of the house, including our bedroom, and they took whatever they wanted. So we got up to see that things were missing, but we were definitely in a deep sleep. And I believe God put us in a deep sleep for our own protection. God can do whatever he wants. And for David's protection, he put that army in a deep sleep, and not one of them woke up. That is all the backdrop for the speeches. In verse 13, David returns toward his men. He crossed over to the other side and stood on top of the hill some distance away. There was a wide space between them. He called out to the army and to Abner, son of Ner, "Aren't you going to answer me, Abner?" He doesn't speak to Saul as he had done before. It hasn't seemed to do much good. So he speaks to the commander of the army. Abner replied, "Who are you who's calling to the king?" David doesn't answer and identify himself, but he continues to speak to Abner. "You are a man, aren't you? And who is like you in Israel? Why didn't you guard your lord, the king? Someone came to destroy your lord, the king. What you have done is not good. As surely as the Lord lives, you and your men must die because you did not guard your master, the Lord's anointed. Look around you. Where are the king's spear and water jug that were near his head?" Now, Abner is a courageous soldier and commander. He was the commander when David killed Goliath. He's the one who found out who David was and introduced him to Saul. But here, David is making a point that Abner and his men have not protected their king. Abner, of course, is stunned by what he hears, and he doesn't even answer. He has no words. But Saul has recognized David's voice, and this is what he says. "Is that your voice, David, my son?" Same thing that he had said back in the En-Gedi cave. "Is that your voice, David, my son?" David replied, "Yes, it is, my lord, the king." And he added, "Why is my lord pursuing his servant? What have I done, and what wrong am I guilty of?" And in verse 19, David gives this powerful speech to Saul. It begins with these words, "Now let my lord, the king, listen to his servant's words. If the Lord has incited you against me, then may he accept an offering. If, however, people have done it, may they be cursed before the Lord. They have driven me today from my share in the Lord's inheritance and have said, 'Go serve other gods.' Now do not let my blood fall to the ground far from the presence of the Lord. The king of Israel has come out to look for a flea as one hunts a partridge in the mountains." David had made that reference to a flea back before. "Against whom has the king of Israel come out? Who are you pursuing, a dead dog, a flea?" David is not referring to his insignificance as a person. He's referring to the insignificance of the threat. "I'm no more of a threat to you than a flea is." As if you were chasing for a flea, even a flea on a dead dog. But David expresses what his greatest fear is. His greatest fear is being driven away from the presence of the Lord. The land of Israel represented the presence of the Lord. David has had to live as a fugitive, and he fears that he will be driven away from Israel to a pagan land where there are pagan gods. Saul responds. Then Saul said, "I have sinned. Come back, David, my son, because you considered my life precious today. I will not try to harm you again. Surely I've acted like a fool and have been terribly wrong." He has been a fool. He's Nabal's companion. He has made a great mistake. He goes further than he did before, even asked David to come back. But David knows that Saul's promises are very fleeting and they can't be counted on. So David has no intentions of going back, that Saul would never honor his promises. So David's response is, "Here is the king's spear," David answered. "Let one of your young men come over and get it. The Lord rewards everyone for their righteousness and faithfulness." The Lord delivered you into my hands today, but I would not lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. As surely as I valued your life today, so may the Lord value my life and deliver me from all trouble. David makes it very clear, I'm not trusting in you to save my life. I am trusting in the Lord to save my life. His answer is, here's your spear, O king. The spear represented victory over Saul. Symbolically, David can claim a victory. Here is the spear that I could have killed you with. And here is your water jug that represents sustenance. I am returning both of them. It was very much a symbolic victory. But David makes a statement, which is a statement that we all should hear very clear today. What David is saying in verse 23, the Lord rewards everyone for their righteousness and faithfulness. David has learned what matters most in life is righteousness and faithfulness. The Lord's faithfulness to us and our faithfulness back to him. The last thing that Saul ever says to David in verse 25, then Saul said to David, may you be blessed, David, my son. You will do great things and surely triumph. So David went on his way and Saul returned home. Now this is the last time that the two of them will ever see each other and will ever speak, because Saul will face his death at the hands of the Philistines shortly. And David is still on the move. The harrowing experiences he's experienced as a fugitive from Saul, having come so close to death so many times. But he has also, in all of these experiences, seen the hand of God, seen God's faithfulness, God's grace, God's mercy being shown to him. That is very clear in the Psalms, and many of the Psalms that are actually written during this period and actually attributed at the beginning of the Psalm to this same period, these fugitive years where David is writing the Psalms and telling us at what he is going through. David exhibited righteous behavior in sparing Saul's life. He exhibited faithfulness in trusting God to take care of Saul and not trying to make things happen on his own. God would honor that righteousness and that faithfulness in David's life. David was a faithful man. He would fail ultimately in his life. But God's faithfulness is the foundation of his character. That is seen all the way through the entire Bible, God's righteousness and God's faithfulness. It is what we strive for in our own lives. Listen to a few of these verses. I had over 20 of them, and I think I cut it down to 8. First of all, this is a prayer, one of the greatest prayers in the Bible. The first one comes from Nehemiah. Nehemiah is declaring God's righteousness and faithfulness, and he's praying for forgiveness even though he wasn't even alive or wasn't even present whenever this sin is being committed. He said, in all that has happened to us, you have remained righteous, you have acted faithfully while we acted wickedly, underscoring God's faithfulness and God's righteousness. Psalm 89:14, written by David. Righteousness and justice are the foundation of your throne. Love and faithfulness go before you. Isaiah 11:5. Righteousness will be his belt and faithfulness the sash around his waist. These describe God. Isaiah 16:5. In love a throne will be established, and faithfulness a man will sit on it, one from the house of David, one who in judging seeks justice and speeds the cause of righteousness. That's a description of Jesus. Zechariah 8:8. I will bring them back to live in Jerusalem. They will be my people, and I will be faithful and righteous to them as their God. David sought to be faithful. He sought to be righteous. And as a king, he was extraordinarily different from kings of his age. So much so that the mercy he showed, the way he ruled, was absolutely incredible for his times. Though David would fail, the Lord Jesus did not fail. Without qualification, he is described as the righteous one. Peter described him this way: to those who through the righteousness of our God, underscore the righteousness of our God, and Savior Jesus Christ have received a faith as precious as ours. It's his righteousness that we receive our righteousness. We don't have any. If we receive any, It comes from him. It's like a five-year-old who has some money. If he has any money, it's because he got it from his parents. He doesn't have a way of making his own money. If we have any righteousness, if we have any faithfulness, it comes from God. John, in his first letter, writes, "My dear children, I write this to you so that you will not sin. But if anybody does sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous one." Same writer, John, in writing in the book of Revelation, "I saw heaven standing open, and there before me was a white horse whose rider is called Faithful and True. With justice he judges and wages war." Whose rider is called Faithful and True. That is the reason we're here today, is to seek his righteousness and to seek his faithfulness in our life. If there is any transformation, it's because he does the work. If there's any faithfulness to our life, it's because he helps us to be faithful. He helps us to be righteous. David was learning that in his life. The process was difficult, and at the time it would make no sense, and it would be very difficult, but as he would look back over the years and see it, he would see that God was teaching him lessons and showing him mercy and teaching him restraint. You can imagine, if you're king, there's no need to show restraint. That's what kings did. But God wanted another kind of king who knew restraint, who knew mercy, who knew justice, who knew faithfulness. So all of these 13 years, God was making a king that could be faithful and righteous. And that's what God is doing, even in our trials and troubles, is to teach us to be faithful and to be righteous.